My name is Brent Price. I want to welcome you to this Bible study in Revelation chapter 14. In our previous study, we studied Revelation chapter 14, verses 1 through 7. In this study, we want to start with Revelation 14 and verse 8 and move over to go down through verse 13. So we're going to pull up the text here, and we're going to be reading from the American Standard Translation as we've done with previous classes. We have our regular two teachers with us, Ivy Connor and Lonnie Woodruff as well. They'll be joining us momentarily. John said, beginning in Revelation 14 and verse 8, and another. A second angel followed, saying, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the great, that hath made all the nations to drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication." And another angel, a third, followed them, saying with a great voice, "If any man worshipeth the beast and his image, and receiveth a mark on his forehead or upon his hand, he also shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is prepared unmixed in the cup of his anger. And he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment goeth up forever and ever, and they have no rest day and night, they that worship the beast in his image, and whoso receiveth the mark of his name. Here is the patience of the saints, they that keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. And I heard the voice from heaven saying, Write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from henceforth. Yea, saith the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors, for their works follow with them." This is our reading. We're going to let Ivy make his way through the text in a general way, give us a working outline. Then we're going to go back to verse 8, talk about that for a little bit, and then after that, we'll pick up 2 to 3 verses at a time. Ivy, let's turn things over to you, please.
Okay, after the desperate situation in chapter 13, the enemies of God, the terrible three, the dragon, chapter 12, 13, you got the sea beast and the earth beast creating mayhem among the people of God. And we need kind of a pause, and you have what we call a parenthesis or a intermission, like we had in chapter 7 of the 144,000. And that was the good news in chapter 7, because the people on earth, the 144,000 representing the church on earth, the people of God on earth. We studied that with the numbers and so forth. If you didn't get that, I'd recommend maybe you go back and check that lesson, whatever that lesson was, Brad. But anyway, go back and check the lesson I think it's about lesson 3 or 4 in our series where we talked about that. But he says here that this 144,000 is now here showing victory on Mount Zion. And Mount Zion is the church of our Lord. It's the city of Jerusalem in a literal way in the olden times. But now that was done away with the destruction of Jerusalem. So it's the heavenly scene, Mount Zion, where the throne is, and also it's the church. And the Hebrews 12, I think Lonnie covered that pretty well, 22 through 28, 29, talks about the kingdom of God, including all of these things, including the church. And so that's all the saved that we have, and we may go back over that again sometime. But 144,000, we're learning a song. They heard this voice from heaven, and they were singing the song, and only the 144,000 could learn. And he goes on and talks about, "These were they that were not defiled with women, for they are virgins, and they are the ones who follow the Lamb wherever he goes." So it's not heaven. They're still following the Lamb. We're still following the Lamb down here, working with him, walking with him. It's the church of God on earth. The 144,000 represents, first of all, the 12 times 12,000. 12 represents the church, 12 tribes in the Old Testament. You've got 12 apostles in the New Testament. Now, those are round symbolic numbers there. And the 1,000 represents all there is. I think it's Psalm 50:10 talks about the cattle on 1,000 hills belong to God. Well, that's all the cattle belong to God, but the 1,000 hills simply means all there is. And you multiply 12 times 1,000, you've got the church on earth, all there is. And well, you say they're Jews. Yeah, they're Jews, but that's the people of God. That's the symbology of the people of God as to the church, the Israel of God, and the church is signified, denoted in that way. So we have these 144,000 back, and they're going to deliver some good news, and that's part of our lesson tonight that we will get into fairly extensively here. And I'll let it go back to you, Brad.
Okay, I'm going to ask Lonnie to jump in here for a little bit as well. But when you look at the book of Revelation, and Lonnie's done a good job, and Ivy too, as far as drawing contrasts, you have 1 John does a good job of this, also in Revelation. Just it seems like it's contrast after contrast. Think about what we have here. Jesus on one side, the devil on the other side. The Lord's people, the saved, the unsaved. You also have the mother of harlots in contrast to the Lord's mother. You find the mark of the beast that we have back in Revelation chapter 13. In contrast to that, Revelation 14 and verse 1, the name of God written on the forehead. You have the people standing on Mount Zion, the saved, Revelation 14 and verse 1. Now we've got information about Babylon, the organization or the power that's associated with the unsaved. You've got the virgins back in Revelation chapter 14 and verse 4. And again, not literally, that is a figurative description for purity. And you have in contrast to that now the fornication, which is associated with Babylon. And probably that is a lot of spiritual unfaithfulness. You've got the way of the righteous that we saw back in verse 7. And then when we get down there in just a little bit, you have the opposite of that. You have a beast, the beast worship in verse 9. Then when you get down to the latter part of this chapter, you again find additional contrast to show a really unmistakable difference between the saved and the lost. I'm persuaded that there are a lot of people today who do not see much of a distinction between someone who is a Christian and someone who is not. Now, I don't know, maybe it's a mixture as far as whose fault it is. Maybe the non-Christians don't understand that much about Christianity, or maybe it's the Christian who doesn't understand that much about Christianity. But when you look through the book of Revelation, even if you struggle with some of the symbols, it is clear, it is extremely clear that there is a huge, there is a vast, there is a dramatic difference between the people of God and the people who are unsaved. And that is a critical lesson from the book. When you look at Babylon, and we saw a little of this in Revelation chapter 11, we're going to see a little later, especially when you get up in the area of Revelation chapter 18. But who or what is Babylon? Well, people would define that in different ways. I think you're going to hear from Ivy some emphasis on Rome. Lonnie's going to, I think, perhaps take that in at least a slightly different direction. But if you want a general explanation, Babylon is tied in with what I said just a few minutes ago. It is basically the devil's empire. And in the first century, that certainly was ancient Rome. When we think about Babylon, it is a way of saying essentially that Christians live in exile. When you think about Babylon in the Bible, it is that really that system of confusion. It symbolizes, as Smalley said, all human institutional arrogance, which seeks to usurp the sovereignty of God. Now, that's happened at different times, different places, but it certainly was part of ancient emperor worship. Eventually, though, the Bible teaches, and here's an example of that Rome, like every other anti-God power on earth, is going to fall. It doesn't matter how great it is, greatness in terms perhaps of size, greatness in terms of power, greatness in terms of perhaps adherence. Lonnie and Ivy have both written on this, and I think Lonnie in his book talked about the number of adherents, the people who are willing. It's kind of the wide way, so to speak, at least one of the ways to follow that way. But God rules over the nations of the earth. That's an Old Testament principle. You can see it back in the Psalm 22 and verse 8. Revelation chapter 12 and verse 5, another Old Testament reference would be Psalm 47 and verse 8. And because God rules over the nations, he has the ability to lift them up and bring them down. Paul reminded the people there in the area of Athens about that in Acts chapter 17 and verse 26. Well, this way of Babylon, when we get a little later into the book, we're going to see in Revelation chapter 18 and verse 23. You could also check out Revelation 19, 20 and Revelation 20, 10, but especially in Revelation 18, 23, you find that Babylon was using deceit among other techniques. You certainly have the force that we saw back in Revelation chapter 13, but they were deceiving people, leading people astray. And John describes that here in Revelation chapter 14 and verse 8 as drinking or partaking. I checked the Greek text today, earlier today, and John describes that drinking. He describes that partaking with the perfect tense. That tense would indicate that this was something that had started in the past and it was continuing on. This was something that the people in John's day were certainly, it was a long-standing practice. It reminds me, and I think some others, of someone becoming addicted to a drug. And that is just the way life is. And that was the way of Babylon. It looked great for a time. And people who were involved with it were surely satisfied. But eventually, again, Revelation 18 and verse 2, that way begins to fall apart and people began to realize that that was not a good system. I've got some reasons as far as why Babylon came down. I'm going to hold those for just a little bit. And then let's go over to you, Lonnie, see if you have some things, and then we'll come back and see if Ivy has some things, a couple more little points from me, and then we'll move down a little more.
Okay, I'm not sure how much more I can add than what's already been said here. I'll just a brief summary again, but I think it's almost unfortunate that chapter 13 and chapter 14 are divided. This is all one subject. It's talking about the beast, the two beasts in chapter 13, and then it talks about obviously the number 666. And people for some reason, that number fascinates them, and they want to go to that number and stop and try to figure out who that is. And we've talked about that before. But the real point here is that these two chapters really, really go together. We talked about the beast in chapter 13. And then when we get to chapter 14, we start talking about the opposite of that. We talk about Christians. In Mount Zion, the 144,000 is talking about Christians. So we're getting the contrast between chapter 13 and chapter 14. And you almost can't study one without studying the other one. So as we get down into the message of the angels that we're talking about here, and down to verse 14:8 that has been our attention to begin with tonight, says Babylon has fallen. Now, again, I would encourage you greatly to, as you study Revelation, to go back and look at what was taking place in the Old Testament. Babylon held God's people captive. God basically turned Israel over to Babylon because Israel had left God and was not following God. But Babylon held them captive and was quite cruel to them, and God punished them for that. So what we see here then in verse 8, the Babylon has fallen, the great city, she has been made to drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. And again, as we study Revelation, I've told people this, and I'll make the statement here, that it's almost impossible to study Revelation and get the connections all together that are in the book without having gone through it once. Revelation is it's a book that accumulates knowledge as we go. And for instance, in this verse about Babylon, we can go over to chapter 17 and look, and I need to go to chapter 17 right quick. 17, verse 5, it says that on her forehead, now this is talking about the great harlot. It says, and on her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great. So the harlot in chapter 17's name was Babylon the Great. And so we make comparisons between what was happening in chapter 17 with this great harlot that was holding God's people captive with the verse that we're looking at in chapter 14 about Babylon being fallen. So Babylon is going to fall. There's no doubt about it, because she has held God's people captive. And I think in this case, it's probably talking about spiritual captivity. Those who are following the beast are in spiritual captivity. And so whether it be religious teaching or whether it be whatever kind of captivity, but mostly religious teaching. And in chapter 18, you see that Christians are told to come out of her, to come out of Babylon. So you have to make connections with all of these verses in order to understand what Babylon is talking about here. And then it says, and she made all nations to drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. Well, that is repeated in chapter 17. So you have to have a little understanding at least of chapter 17 to understand precisely what's being talked about here in chapter 14. So Revelation, just the knowledge and the understanding of this book just increases as you go through it again and again and again. So that's what I would recommend us doing. So Babylon is here, and Babylon will fall, and the Christians will be the ones who are victorious. All right, Brad, I'll turn it back to you.
All right, thank you. I had a teacher a long time ago that drilled something into the minds of his students, and one of those students happened to be me. He made the point, especially from the Old Testament prophets, that God judges people in eternity. Nations are judged in time.
Right.
I never really thought about that until he made that point, and that is a point which is replete. It's frequent in Scripture. There's just no way. I mean, in nation, oftentimes you have Christians there. We might say even almost always you have Christians there. So it's impossible to judge that nation, the entire nation of people in eternity. But people, individuals, that's the place where they go to ultimately heaven or hell. But nations are dealt with in time. And sometimes when you have a very bad nation, and ancient Rome would definitely be a great example of that, God has brought them down. And you begin to see some specific reasons for that. Thinking about this Babylon, when you look a little later in the book, and Lonnie was pointing out some of those passages, you really find, I think, four specific reasons why Babylon was brought down by God. Reason number one was pride. The Bible has a lot to say about pride, and sometimes people use the word pride in a way which is not bad. They say, I'm proud of my work. They're not being haughty, but when we talk about sinful pride, we're talking about haughtiness. We're talking about arrogance. And this Babylon had pride, Revelation 18:7, Revelation 18:23. There was also a strong emphasis on luxury, materialism, the things of this world, Revelation chapter 18, verses 11 through 17. And as you look at Revelation 18 and verse 13, the end of that verse, sometimes that luxury, sometimes the finer things of life, those items were achieved or accumulated by injuring or interfering with the lives of others. False religion, we've already seen that. Again, I think Alani made a great point as far as we don't have any chapter and verse divisions in the original text. And if you draw that distinction between 13 and 14, well, we've got a new chapter, you really lose a key point. But we do have false religion associated with baptism, Babylon. And you'll see that places like Revelation 19 and verse 20. And then you've also got, and this was especially severe, the persecution, the fierce, the awful persecution. And Ivy has done a great job over our lessons as far as talking about that. But Revelation 17, 5 and 6, which Lonnie referred to just a little bit ago, it's in Revelation 18, 24, in Revelation 19 and verse 2, especially the latter part of that. And when you think about those four things, pride, strong emphasis on luxury, materialism, the things of this world, false religion, and the persecution of God's people, you can almost put America as far as, we're not talking, you know, not saying that Revelation is about America, but as far as those four things and looking at modern life and saying that America does, at least in some respects, fall into this same basic category. And that's probably not going to bode well for us at some point in the future unless we get things turned around. Ivy, anything that you want to go back and discuss before we look at 9 through 11?
Just a few things here. Babylon, also worldliness, the way she's dressed,
sure,
the way she acts, the seduction, that worldliness can apply to America or anybody else. Now, folks, because it applies, doesn't mean it's fulfilled. We have a lot of typology. We have enough similarity. We have enough things going on. We say, well, that's fulfilling Revelation. No, Revelation's fulfilled as I understand it. Now, anything that happens like that we could go back and we have an ear to hear, let's hear it. We're supposed to apply Revelation to current events. Doesn't necessarily mean it's fulfillment of that.
Correct.
Just because it repeats that. But what Lonnie said to start with was terrific from the standpoint that he says, well, you need to read it the second time and study it the second and third and fourth time. Every time I study the book, I learn new stuff. I don't just mean one or two things. And it's a delightful thing that you can continue to plumb the depths of this book. And I don't think anybody's got it all. I know I don't. And it's a fabulous book from the standpoint that, but it, again, I'm a simple guy. I wrote a book, a commentary on Revelation, 100 pages. And I called it Simple Studies in Revelation for Simple People by a Simple Teacher. That would be me. And I'm a simple guy. I got through third grade. You know, that's pretty good. So I am a simple guy. And we get too complex to fight going around and around. I'll let the Bible interpret the Bible, and I want to let Revelation interpret itself. It will do that. We have some this is that type statements from Acts 2. This is that spoken by Joel. And if this is that's it. And so we can, I think, plumb what Babylon is to start with. Just out of Revelation, we stay there, and we're careful with the text, and we honor the time frame of shortly come to pass. We do all those things. I think we're in great shape. So very quickly here, who's Babylon? Well, she's fallen. We don't know anything about Babylon. The old Babylon's dead and lost. They don't know where it was back in 2,000 years ago. Hadn't found it yet. Had been buried so long. And Babylon was a horrible enemy of God. But he says Babylon is fallen. That's right in the middle of this discussion, but that's good news. The 144,000, hey, this is some of the good news. A lot of good news here in the rest of this chapter that we're going to talk about. But it's important that we appreciate the fact whatever Babylon is. Now we pick up Babylon, as Lonnie and Brad have already talked about, chapter 17, 18. And what I just discovered again, and I knew this, but I just didn't make it connected everything. Chapter 18, verse 2 says the same thing. Babylon is falling. It's going to fall. Didn't say that. He said it's fallen. Now, we'll go back to what I think both Brad and Lonnie said, is that victory is what we're talking about. If that's all you learn in this study of 22 chapters, that we have victory, and if you want a three-word analysis of the book, victory in Jesus, that's the story. He's the Nike. That word means to win, to victory, and that word is used throughout the book of Revelation. The word victory is there, and overcoming, that's the word victory, or Nike, which means to overcome, to conquer, or to win. We are the winners. Satan's number 666. He's already lost. He's already, in essence, fallen. And the idea that he's fallen, that it's fallen, it isn't. And he tells you, I hate to jump, but we're jumping around, and that's okay. We're far enough into the book now, I think, Lonnie and Brad, that we can kind of reveal some of these things and tantalize people a little bit. But in chapter 17, the last verse, he tells you who Babylon is. You got a this is that, guys. I mean, and it doesn't take interpolation or much interpretation. He says in here, he says, the woman which you saw is the great city. Now, the holy city was Jerusalem. It was the church. The great city, and it was never the otherwise, except there's one mistranslation in King James. But always the great city is referring to Rome. And the holy city is the church. So he says, the woman you saw is the great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. That Babylon is fallen, but she right now is reigning over the people of the earth, but she's going down quickly. It's going to shortly come to pass. And that's from within the book. That's just staying within the book. You wake up a Roman in the middle of the night, 3 a.m. back in the first century. Hey, quick, who rules the world? 3 a.m. say, hey, go back to sleep. Everybody knows Rome rules the world. Rome is this Babylon. And the persecution that they did with the blood of Christians, that is all historic. So that's my point with that. That just this is so rich and so good. And as you learn these little tidbits as you go along, you're gonna see more. Now we do have some disagreements on that. That's fine. It's for you to study. Okay, Brad. Hey,
a couple quick points here. I wanted to throw out in the Old Testament, and John was surely familiar with this. You read through the prophets, for example, and God will say, this has been done, or the nation has fallen. And you go back, you read the next verse, and they're still operating. You know, right. It still seems like they're doing great. And some people have really scratched their heads and said, well, how can that be? I mean, God says, you know, you're done, game over. But at the same time, the next verse says, or the next chapter somewhere else in the book, or maybe another book says, that was not true at the time. Well, that's what is often referred to as a prophetic perfect. In other words, God has described some things sometimes that, anything with God, when he makes a promise, it's sure, it's secure. But there were times where the prophets used that kind of language to reassure people that this is really what is taking place. God's got a plan, he's working, and this is going to be the end result, whether you see it or not. So I don't know, Lonnie, Ivy, if you want to talk about that for a second or not, the prophetic perfect. I'm kind of thinking that here in Revelation 14 and verse 8, when John says, fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great, he's using that same kind of technique to say, this is something that you can depend on. This is something that's sure and secure.
I think everybody will agree that prophecy is tricky, because you have it saying something that has happened that is still in the future. But when God says it, it's true. I mean, it's happening. It's a mystery. It's the mystery made more perfect. Prophecy made more perfect is when it's fulfilled. But when God said it, it's true. Babylon, it said it four times there now. So whoever this Babylon is, we don't know this far into the book. Now, they probably knew who Babylon was, but we it's revealed to us who it is. And chapter 17 and 18 is just a whole laundry list of destruction and things that were going on with Rome and everything as he pictures Babylon fallen. It's Rome and their enemies are absolutely destroyed because of this is going on. And what they see as it's taken apart piece by piece, furniture, perfume, blessings, all of these things that Roman gave the people was taken away. So there is much, much here, and it's a beautiful thing. So I think that, we're getting into Babylon and everything. We got two whole chapters to spend on that. So everybody hang on.
Brad, yeah, I want to make a point here just in case, I just need to do this in case somebody has said this is what I believe. I do not believe Babylon is Rome. So as we follow along in the two different ideas here about what this is, I think Babylon is any force on this earth today who holds God's people spiritually captive. Whether it be great spiritual entities or denominations or whatever, I think it represents those who hold God's people spiritually captive. I want to read, if I could, for just a second. I want to go back to Isaiah chapter 53, I'll just read verse 7. And this is a well-known prophecy of Jesus Christ. And it says, he was oppressed. And he was afflicted. Now, this is about 500 years before he was crucified. But it says he was, present tense, or past tense, oppressed. He was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He was led as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before his shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. Now, the point of that is a prophecy of some 500 years that is written in past tense. Now, you find that in prophecy a lot, because God is eternal. He is setting in all times. So when he says Babylon is fallen, it does not necessarily mean that we have to pinpoint at that particular time what that Babylon may have meant and try to attach a certain meaning to it, because it is going to happen. Prophecy is written in some cases just like it's already taken place. And that is true in Isaiah. So when we read this passage about Babylon and we want to attach exactly who it is, I don't believe we can do that. I believe that it's the one who, it's the spiritual entities or spiritual forces in this world that hold God's people captive, and Babylon will fall at the end of time or sometime at God's choosing. But that doesn't mean that it's not existent today, because I very much believe Babylon is existent today, just like the beast that we studied earlier are existent today. They are the forces of government in this world that hold God's people captive in that manner. And Babylon holds God's people spiritually captive today. Just wanted to make that point so people right. know where we're coming
all
from.
Right. We're allowing both views to be presented. Let's move down now as far as the adversaries to verses 9 and 11. Now we have a third angel. And John says there's not only a third angel, but this third angel is able to speak with a great voice. The message is very similar to what we have back in Revelation chapter 13. He goes back and talks about worshiping the beast, the image receiving the mark on the forehead or upon the hand. But now John says something else. If you do that, if you are willing to accept the mark of the beast, then verse 10, Revelation 14, you're going to drink of God's wine. And the word wrath is also associated with that. And then that wine from God is described as being unmixed. The word anger is also used. And then we have this torment with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and the Lamb. And then in verse 11, the smoke of the torment goes up and up. The people have no rest day and night. The people who worship the beast, the image, the people who receive the mark. Now, when the Bible talks about any man here, I would understand that to be literal, any person, whether you became a Christian or not. Perhaps you were never interested in Christianity, but if you worship the beast, if you do what is described back there in Revelation chapter 13, and you get that mark, you accept the way of the beast, then you have essentially denied Christ, whether you're a Christian or not. You have rejected Christianity, whether you are a Christian or not. And certainly for people in and around the first century, one very easy way to do that would be involvement with Rome and the emperor worship and so forth. I think Lonnie or Ivy talked about this in a previous session. I'm not sure which one, but when you think about the forehead, perhaps those are things associated with the mind in terms of false religion. When you think about the image of the hand, that would be a more direct kind of service and a different kind of acceptance. Some have looked at Revelation 14 and verse 9 and thought that this is some kind of tattoo from the devil. No, that's not the point. It is one more way. It's one more illustration to say there are two choices. You can be with the saved. You can be with the righteous. And that's always been true, even under the Old Testament era, or you can be with the unsaved. You can be with the devil. If you want to be with the devil, expect the wrath of God unless you right your life with God before you leave this life. God says that for the unrighteous, they deserve the unmixed cup of his anger. That is no mercy. It looks like this image goes back to an ancient practice. People would dilute wine before drinking it. It said that one part wine was mixed with two-fourths parts water, depending on the type of wine, 2 to 4 parts of water, depending on the wine. And if you didn't do that, then that was a really bad sign. Basically, the thing that people were that wanted to go out and, you know, really end up intoxicated. That's what they did. But John uses that image to say that sin is serious. Sin is really bad. And if you find yourself on the wrong side of God, it is not going to drink. It's not going to bode well. Paulet, in his commentary, said this, and I like the quote: "Jesus drained the cup of sorrow and suffering for us," pointing back to Matthew chapter 26, "in order that we might not taste the wrath of God in eternity. Those who will not believe this, not receive him into their hearts in saving faith, shall drink the cup of infinite and eternal suffering." And John talks about suffering. Ivy may want to explore this a little bit. There are two ways to look at that. Some would look at that in a literal way. Some would look at that perhaps in a symbolic way. Whichever way you look at, the description does not sound good. He talks about being tormented with fire, with brimstone, in the presence of the holy angels, and also in the presence of the Lamb forever and ever. No rest, day and night. Jesus, you may remember, and maybe that's what John was pulling from. Jesus talked a lot about fire. He used illustrations like a furnace of fire, eternal fire. He talked about Mark 9:48, the fire that is not quenched. John also mentioned brimstone. That seems to denote or describe sulfur, a non-metallic yellowish element that burns with a blue flame, and also emitting that noxious, suffocating sulfur dioxide gas. It creates intense heat. That's not a new image. You have that back in Genesis 19 and verse 24. You can find that in the Psalms. We're also going to find that in Revelation 19, 20 and Revelation chapter 21. John is describing, as far as the unsaved, no rest, verse 11. He's describing torment, which does not cease. The idea that non-Christians somehow get off scot-free is one of the greatest lies that's ever been told. I am kind of curious, and maybe Lonnie or Ivy will have some additional ideas about this, but describing the punishment in the presence of Jesus and the angels, exactly what John means by that. My best guess is that John is saying that the angels and Jesus will approve, or they will declare the correctness of the punishment. When it's been time to punish people, if you take the view that Lonnie has been advancing, if you accept the view that Ivy's been advancing, when punishment came, God's punishment is always going to be just. Do not draw from this, if you look at this as far as something that points to eternity as far as the punishment, do not think that saved people are going to be able to somehow see. There's not like a big glass portal where people can look and see the people that are going to be suffering for eternity in hell. I say that that's not going to be the case because of what Paul said in 2 Thessalonians chapter 1 and verse 9. He talked about the unsaved being separated, shut off from the presence of God and so forth. So there's not going to be any kind of spiritual window into hell. It can cost Christians a lot to be faithful to Christ, but that's the point that John is trying to drive home. Again, as Lonnie mentioned, do not see big separation between 13 and 14. You can go the way that's described in Revelation 13 and experience all the bad consequences. You can be faithful to Christ. And here, when you look at the word patience, that's going to be in Revelation chapter 14 and verse 12. It means endure. Endure, whatever that means for your life. You might lose property. You might lose wealth. You might lose health. You might lose your life. Whatever the cost, it's worth it. Revelation 2:10, even if it requires death, be faithful. All right. Let's go back to you, Ivy or Lonnie, verses 9 through 11. See if there's some things that you want to deal with.
I'll go.
Okay.
I didn't know who was going. Okay. I think I agree with most of what has been said there with Brad. The third angel, if anyone worships the beast in his image, and that throws us right back to chapter 13, or has the mark on his forehead or in his hands. Now that's, that's inclusive as far as I'm concerned of anybody that lives on this earth and follows the beast, has the mark of the beast, or is pledges their allegiance to something else other than God and follows that, has the mark on the forehead. And then verse 10, he himself also drank the wine of the wrath of God and has poured out full strength into the cup of his indignation, tormented with fire and brimstone. And I just think that just simply shows what will happen to them. That will be the final judgment. That will be what will happen to them in eternity, is that they will be tormented with fire and brimstone. We're told that in other places without having to chase those down. But the presence of God and his holy angels, presence of the Lamb, as Brad was talking about, and I agree with that. I just think they pronounce the punishment and then they will be cast into punishment forever. And I don't think we will have any. I think it says there's a great gulf between in one place. And remember, all of this is symbolism. But the good will be separated from the evil at that time. And I don't think that we have to worry about whether there will be, as Brad put it, a window into hell. I don't think that's what's happening here, but I think that they will be cast into the lake of fire and burned with fire and brimstone. And then the smoke of the torment ascends up forever and ever. I mean, that's what we teach. That's what we preach. That's what is going to happen to people who don't follow God. They will be cast into torment and it will be forever and ever. It will not be for a few years or a few days or whatever. It will be an eternal torment. And that those who do have no rest day or night, who worship the beast in his image, or who receives the mark of his name, that's telling you who's going to go there to that eternal torment. And I'll save verse 12 then until we get Brad's ready for it. Okay.
Okay. Ivy, let's go back to you, 9 through 11. Some things
here. Yeah, let's hit the good news on this. That's one thing. And again, let me start with this. The book, the fundamental hermeneutic is, in Bible interpretation understanding, is this had to mean something to them. They were in the furnace of affliction. They were seeing all of this mark and can't buy and being slaughtered and the blood being shed. And that's what this book is focused on. And we try to focus on the end of the world or the fire and eternal hell. I think you're stretching it, folks. I mean, I talked about, hey, did a little cat and a fiddle. What did a cow do? Jumped over the moon. Man, we're jumping over Revelation 1 and Revelation 22. I mean, the cow did nothing compared to just leaping over. This is shortly coming to pass, shortly coming to pass, coming quickly, shortly coming, five times in 22. What does that mean? Does it mean the end of the world? No, it does not. And let's frame this in light of what it meant to them. And that's my concern, that we're way off of this. Now, I'm the guy then that says, you know, this was to them, and it was written to them. Revelation 1, 1 through 3, we're blessed if we read it, but the time was at hand. At hand doesn't mean 2,000 years. And so there is a disagreement here. Again, if something happens today, we can relate to the book of Revelation. Not that it's fulfilled there, but that's the principle that we need to do to fight whatever the issue is. So let's look at three things of good news now. The 144,000 is in victory on Mount Zion. And here are the good. He says, another angel flew in heaven, verse 6, and he had the eternal gospel to preach to those who are on the earth and to every nation and tribe. Now that's good news. They're going to preach the gospel. And they said with a loud voice, fear God and give him glory. You know, don't worry about the Romans. Don't worry about the enemy right now. Fear God, give him the glory, because the hour of his judgment is come. Not 2,000 years away, but the judgment of this Babylon, of this nation, of this country is coming. And he says they're going to see it. The second angel comes and says, fallen is Babylon the Great. Babylon has fallen. So he says that's good news. Whatever's going to happen with Babylon, if that's Rome, she's going to get it. And we can be guaranteed of that. And then the third angel comes and he says with him, anybody worships the beast and his image receives the mark, guess what's going to happen to him? He's going to be nailed. He's going to be absolutely overcome and wiped out. So there are the things that we have here that refer back to the situation at hand and what's going on there with that. So that is the distinction of the difference there. And again, you've got twice in Revelation 1, 1 through 3, the parameters of the book. You can't just say, hey, and leap past 22. We're still on the earth with the nations living, and God's judgment is coming to pass. So that's my two cents on this one. And I will jump into 12 and say my piece there. Here's perseverance of the saints. Keep the commandment of God and their faith in Jesus. So keep doing what God says. Don't give up in the face of this problem.
Well, Ivy, pick up 13 as well, where John says, and I heard the voice from heaven saying, right, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from henceforth, yea, saith the Spirit, that they may rest from the labors, for their works follow with them.
All right. He is simply saying, you know, if you die in the Lord, you're with the Lord. You have victory. You've Nike'd. You've overcome in the ultimate sense. And then you're going to get the blessings. Now, I've heard brothers say, well, I'm going to get my final reward is heaven. No, heaven's not your reward. Heaven's a gift. A reward is something you earn. It's something you get and awarded. And so the idea that you're saved by grace, not by works, but you're going to get a reward if you are stay in the word of God and the will of God and doing his will, and your works will follow you. So that's part of my thing there. And I was going to go back up in the first part of the chapter where he talks about you're going to drink the wrath of God unmixed. And that means concentrated. Brad, you hit on that some. But you're going to get the full load. You're going to get a snootful of God's judgment. And what the Romans have done, their enemy is going to get this while we have victory. That chapter 14 is a tremendous anthem of praise and victory for Christians. And that's my take on that, if I was specific enough.
Okay, well, here's why I asked the question, not to set you up, but to see if I can illustrate this a little bit better. If we've got in 14:13 information about the people who die faithful, and they have a good outcome in eternity, then would it be a stretch as we back up to what we have there in verses 10 and 11 to say that we've got the contrast to that, we've got the unsaved in 10 and 11, because they've chosen to worship the beast, that's going to be their eternal fate. It's one more contrast.
I think that is a good contrast. Yes. Now let's go to where the smoke is rising up forever and ever. That's
11.
That's 11. Okay. Again, that was said of Babylon, other nations that were judged. You go over there, there's not smoke. When I was a kid, I thought, oh man, Sodom and Gomorrah, man, that smoke's going to go be going up. Going, we go and see it. No. That's a figure of symbolism of permanent judgment and persecution, and fire and brimstone is totally destroyed and full in punishment. And it is used symbolic, and I believe it's symbolic here. I believe it's used symbolic, and this is something you'll have to study, of the Great White Throne. The Great White Throne is not the final judgment if you'll read it carefully. Nobody in the saved goes through the Great White Throne judgment, as you'll see. It was the dead that lived not. Those are the ones that were judged out of the books at first. So we've got a lot of not only compression when we get to this, but the extrapolation, Brad and Lonnie, from this when we get over there. And I think the more we get into this, the more we'll see. I see it clearly. You know, this is to those people in that generation and shortly come to pass within the next few hundred years. And I see that. I appreciate what Lonnie has said and Brad, your input too, but I'm not trying to assume anything here. I'm trying to accept this as it is. And hey, I'll look at every position and I appreciate Lonnie's study and Brad's too of this, Brad, but I'm not sure I nailed your question if you want to ask it more specifically, but again, he's saying, look here and you know, blessed are the dead. If they're dead, then those brothers and sisters that are killed by the Romans, then, you know, they're already there and their works are following them. And they're reigning with the 140, chapter seven, they're reigning with those, Revelation 20 and verse 4, in heaven before the throne now. They're beheaded for the cause of Christ. They go to be with the Lord, and they're there now. The body is still in the grave. But these are victory. These are symbolisms, but it's still truth. And why are we saying all of that out and differentiate that? It may be a little tough, but again, Revelation is pretty simple to me, and maybe I'm too simple. I hope not.
Okay. I think you did fine with the question. I just am currently thinking, at least, that we've got another contrast there. All right. Lonnie, let's go back to you and see if we've got some final thoughts that we can bring together here from 12 and 13. He talks about the patience of the saints or the endurance or keeping the commandments of God. They've got the faith. Notice a definite article. It's in the Greek text as well. They've got the faith of Jesus. We want to make a point about that. And then from heaven, there's this voice saying, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord. From henceforth, the Spirit says that they may rest from their labors and their works follow them. Why don't you take us there?
Okay. The patience and faith of the saints, and in fact, I think it's been well covered. Those who keep the commandments of God, and I don't want to get in a controversial here. I want to tell you what I think, and let Abby tell you what he thinks, and Brad tell you what he thinks, and then you can study it for yourself. But to debate this at this time, I think would be useless. But here it says those who keep the commandments of God. That's any time, not into Rome. It's all those who keep the commandments of God until Christ comes again. So, and the faith of Jesus, I hadn't really made a note on that or anything, but the faith in the New Testament is talked about the gospel. The gospel is the faith. We keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus Christ. It's all the same thing. We have a personal faith and our belief in God, but the faith, I believe it's in Galatians, maybe chapter 2, somewhere along there, where the question was asked, did you receive the gift of the Spirit by the works of the law or by the hearing of faith? How do you hear faith? Well, you hear faith by someone's teaching you the gospel, because that is the faith. And I'll leave the rest of that to you, Brad. And then 13, then I heard a voice from heaven saying to me, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. yea, their spirit rests from their labors and their works befall them. And that's true today and forever. As long as this world stands, that those who are dying the Lord, they will rest from their labors and their works do follow them. I want to point out one passage and just make one comment. First Timothy 5:24 says, some men's sins are clearly evident, preceding them to judgment. But those of some men follow later. Likewise, the good works of some are clearly evident, and those that are otherwise cannot be hidden. I think all what this is saying is that there are people out here doing wonderful, wonderful works for the Lord, but they may not, nobody may know what they're doing. It may be very private. It may be something that no man gives them glory for, or any anything for any accolades for doing what they're doing, but God knows.
That's true. That's true.
And so he says, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord, that their rest from their labors and their works follow them. The works that we have done on this earth will be very evident when we get to glory, I believe. I believe that those who get there will be those who have done those works and things. And so we may not know about what everybody's doing. And, you know, we don't want to seek glory here on this earth. We want God to get the glory. And so I think they rest from their labors and their works follow them. They're taking their good works with them on their way to eternity. All right, Brad.
Okay, I'll say a few things here about 12 and 13, and then we'll see if Ivy can close things out for us. When John talks about endurance, notice again, I keep coming back to this, but you can see it throughout the whole book. He talks about a contrast. He says there are people who keep the commandments of God, and he says there are people who keep or follow the faith of Jesus. Isn't that in contrast to those who keep the commandments of the beast, Revelation 13, and those who keep the face or the system of the beast, Revelation 13. So time and time again, John says you can be in this category or you can be in this category. You can be on this side or you can be on this side. If we're going to be on the side of Christ, then we need to keep the commandments of God. There's some people who say, well, there are no commandments. You believe in commandment keeping, not the 10 commandments, the commandments that we find in the New Testament. Yes. We're not saved by commandment keeping, but we have an obligation. Hebrews 5. Look at verses 8 and 9. It talks about salvation is for those who obey God. We keep his commandments. Jesus said, if you love me, John 14, 15, 15, 14. If you love me, you keep my commandments. 15, 14, you're my friends if you do the things which I command you. Now, someone says, well, you're just afraid of hell, and that's why you obey God. No, John, the fellow who wrote this book, talked about in 1 John how perfect love casts out fear. Christians don't, at least if they're thinking correctly, Christians don't fear hell. They are aware of it. They don't want to go there. But they love God, they want to serve God because of that motivation, and they do keep in mind that unfaithfulness does lead to an unpleasant outcome. When you think about Christians keeping the commandments of God, there's a New Testament verse that comes to mind. That's Luke chapter 13 and verse 24. It's a verse that's not used very often, but Jesus said, strive. If you want to live the Christian life, it's going to require a good bit of effort, and you've got to, pursuing that effort, use endurance, which is here translated patience in some versions. We've got to cling to the faith. Personal faith is necessary, but it does not seem like that's what John is describing here. The faith is what we read about in Romans 6:17. Paul talked about the form of doctrine. He talked about the pattern or the standard of teaching. That's the ESV render. There is a system of faith. When you start looking at this, if you check the Greek text, as far as faith, you'll find several passages in the New Testament, which talk about not just faith, but the faith, the system of faith, a specific way of doing things. And that way means a specific way for becoming a Christian. Sometimes in today's world, you find 10 different plans that people give as far as how to become a Christian. There's just one plan in the Bible. Which church is right? How to worship? What that one church should be organized? All of how that one church should be organized? All of that is part of the faith. And you read about this faith, the faith in Acts 6:7. Acts chapter 14 and verse 22, Acts 24 and 24, Romans 10:8, Galatians 1:23, 1 Timothy 4:1, Revelation 2:13, and some other passages that I will not list. But John and other writers talk about the faith. Definite article is used. Then when we think about John and some of his other writings, think about this contrast. This struck me. I have talked about always learning things new when you read through this book or any book, and that's true. You remember how Jesus talked about dying in sin? John wrote about that, didn't he? John chapter 8 and verse 24, Jesus said, you will die in your sin. Notice another contrast. You can die in your sin, John 8 and verse 24, or now over here in Revelation chapter 14, what's the other choice? You can die in the Lord. For accountable people, those are the only two choices, and they are two very different choices. And John said, if you die in the Lord, your works are going to follow you. Now, I may not have completely figured that out, but I'm thinking that maybe Matthew 6 and verse 20, where Jesus talked about laying up treasure in heaven. And also in that same book, Matthew chapter 10, this time verse 41, where Jesus talked about the seemingly different rewards. He talked about the reward for a righteous man. He talked about the reward for a prophet and so forth. And maybe that's what he has in mind here. We do know that the Old Testament talked about rest. You can read about that back in Joshua chapter 21, verses 43 and 44. Jesus, though, offers the true and the complete and the eternal rest. Some think that's soul sleeping. That's not what the Bible describes in any place, let alone here. When you think about the works following a Christian, is it not true that the works of the non-Christian, the unforgiven sins of the non-Christian, will also follow them into eternity? Right. Yes. And those evil works, those evil deeds will be the basis for eternal condemnation. Here's another thing that maybe you could easily overlook. John uses two different words to describe the activities of Christians. He talks about labors and works. Now, you might be thinking, well, I wonder if there's a difference between those two words, or are they synonyms? It does not seem that they are synonyms. Trench, in his Synonyms of the New Testament, gives 2 Timothy chapter 4, 6 through 8 as a cross-reference, and it does seem like John uses the word labor not just to describe work, but he uses the labor to describe weariness. There are times where people are so exhausted, so whipped, they have spent just about everything that they have that they can barely drive home, or they can barely climb in bed at night, and they say, I have got to rest. God wants his people to work, but God also expects his people to labor. And for Christians who are not willing to work, let alone labor, they should not expect to fare very well at the end of time. Ivy touched on this a little bit. Lonnie really dealt with it as far as God not forgetting what his people
I would love to do that, but I've got to talk about this labor thing for just a minute. I'd love to talk about that. Paul didn't say he worked for Jesus. 1 Corinthians 15:10, he said, I labor, yet more abundantly than they all, that not I, but the grace of God that was within me. I look for what made Paul different than me, and it's his appreciation of grace greatly, and that was what motivated Paul. The grace of God did, not fear, not desire for reward necessarily. All of those things are involved, but this idea of laboring for the Lord by grace. Now, when women go to have a baby, they don't go to the workroom, do they? Where do they go? They go to the labor room. At least they used to. I'm not sure now, all the modernism, but they go to labor. When you labor, you hurt, you sweat, you bleed, you get tired, as Brad said. There's a whole big difference. You can work shirt sleeves, air conditioning, central heat. Man, it's just a breeze. Everything is wonderful. But when you labor, That's real work. And Paul said, we labor. And we had an old song, don't sing it much now. I will work, I'll pray, I will labor every day in the kingdom of the Lord. And we need to be laboring. So that's my 2 cents with that, Brad. I appreciate you giving me a shot at that. And then the last thing here is, again, the 144,000 is fantastic news. In chapter 7, they're sealed, taken care of. If death comes, God's got them. They go join the innumerable multitude in the last part, half of chapter 7. Here at 14, here is this good news about the gospel being preached to every nation. And then he's saying that therefore we ought to fear God, and that his judgment is coming. That's good news. Babylon is fallen. Don't have to worry about it. I know it's a threat. I know it's there, but God's taking care of that. And then the third angel comes along and says, you know, if you're worshiping the beast and so forth, you're going to receive the ultimate judgment. And then he ties these two verses. That's what I wanted to get to, Brad. He says, here's the perseverance of the saints. What is the patience of perseverance of the saints? What is it? It's to continue to serve God, to keep his commandments. You don't quit because of the judgment. You don't quit that with the Ukraine thing that's current right now while we're filming this. But those people haven't quit. They're in the face of adversity, extreme adversity and fear. They're not quitting. They're continuing to go on. And God says, blessed are the dead, they die in the Lord. It's not a blessing thing to die. Unless you die in the Lord, then that's what's blessed. And he says, your works will follow you. And that is a wonderful thing. And not just your salvation, but the works that you give. Even if you give a cup of cold water in the name of Jesus, the Bible says, he'll be remembered. So there are rewards given out, and that's a whole different study we could handle some other time, Brad.
Yeah, it is. I'm going to close out with a little story here. The day that I taught this verse in a Bible class, there was a guest preacher that day, and he talked about a fellow, a missionary in India. The missionary at the time was 80 years old. Perhaps he's dead by now. He said that this 80-year-old missionary preached for five different congregations every Sunday that were near his village. His day started at 7:30 in the morning, and it ended at bedtime. This elderly saint needed to use a cane to walk, and he had his cane walking to all five of those congregations. Eventually, either someone had a good bit of compassion on him, or they were able to come up with some extra money, and he was given a bicycle to get to those congregations in an easier way. And his response, which I'm going to give in just a moment, would shame many Christians. You might think that the standard response would be something like, oh, thank you very much. It will be so much easier now for me to go from place to place. No, he said, thank you. And with gratitude in his eyes, he said, now I can do so much more. He wanted to labor, and may that be our desire as well. Join us next time. Thank you.